Death of a Salesman is perhaps the greatest modern play of all time.
The book that kind of changed my life was, Jesus, is it Seth Godin? And it was The Icarus Deception. That kind of like blew me away and I couldn't stop reading it.
The Power of Now, written by Eckhart Tolle, has changed my views on the way I look at the world.
I've been reading The 48 Laws of Power by Robert Greene on and off for probably the past 10 years.
Beloved by Toni Morrison is one book that really changed my life and the way that I see the world.
As of late, I've been reading that novel that was posted on Reddit, the Interface series. I started reading it, and ever since then, I've kind of just been enthralled with it. It's just a crazy story about kind of government conspiracies. It's
Flow by Mahal Csikszentmihalyi.
You just heard some of our listeners on Anchor talking about the books that have changed their lives, which was the subject of this month's book club, when our guests were authors Susan Orlean, Emma Straub, and Beth Ann Patrick. So, for this week's bonus weekend podcast, we're playing interviews with some authors who have made an impact on your lives. Our audience had a lot to say during our book club that we decided to bring them into our podcast as well. In between interviews, you'll also hear our producers read some of our comments from our show page. We were so happy to hear from our listeners that we don't want it to end. We want more of you to tell us about the book that has made a big influence on your life. So write to us on Facebook or Twitter or at wnyc.org/lopate. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When Juno Diaz's first book, Drown, was published in 1996, it received rave reviews and catapulted the young writer into the top echelons of the literary world. And now, 11 years later, Riverhead has just released his first novel, The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde. And again, the critics have been positively gushing. Michiko Kakutani in the New York Times Review wrote that it is so original it can only be described as Mario Vargas Llosa meets Star Trek meets David Foster Wallace meets Kanye West. I'm very pleased that it has brought Juno Diaz back to my show today. Hi.
Leonard, good to see you again, bro.
And you have also been compared with about 100 other writers, which suggests that you're really doing something right, because if they can't pigeonhole you, that's pretty good. I realize that this is the question everyone's asking, but why did it take 11 years for you to write the second book? Were you blindsided by the acclaim that you'd received for Drown?
Oh, that didn't help. But I also just, I was writing, I tried to write a couple of other books that didn't work out. And I'm one of those people who probably sticks too long on a ship that's going down where anyone else would have jumped out earlier.
Well, what's really important in this book is the voice of the narrator. Actually, there were a couple, but mostly... Junior. Is it Junior or Junior?
Yeah, Junior.
Junior. Well, I've always wondered because the Y is pronounced J in Puerto Rican Spanish. I don't know about Dominican Spanish. His voice is a really important part of this. When you started writing this book, was that right there?
No, it took a very long time to get that equilibrium. The narrator is like, for this book, had to be equally heartbreaking and in my mind had to be equally hilarious. And it's hard to switch on a dime that way. It took forever, Leonard.
Because the story is heartbreaking, largely, and the details are often hilarious.
Yeah, and that seems for me the way life always is. And that's a tough, I mean, I don't know, maybe I'm just tooting my own horn, but it took forever to get that thing right.
Like Drown, this novel revolves around the lives of Dominican immigrants in New Jersey. Your protagonist, Oscar, is an overweight ghetto nerd living with his mother and sister in Patterson. And, of course, that leads to the predictable autobiographical question. You were born in the Dominican Republic. You came here at the age of 6, grew up in New Jersey. But you don't look anything like Oscar Wilde.
Yeah, no, he came to me, it's kind of like Pallas Athena. He sprung clean out of my skull when I was living in Mexico, and I was desperate to write a novel, failing at two novels. And instead of the heroes I kept coming up with, which were like, in some ways, idealized versions of myself or people I knew, this shadow self, this complete opposite of every hero I could have imagined or wanted to be, suddenly sprang to mind.
Should I assume that Yunya, in a way, is more like you? Even the names are kind of similar.
Well, yeah, no, that's even my name. Like, that's
your real name is Yunya?
Yeah, well, that's what no one has ever called me Juno in my family or for the first 20 years. So, yeah, no, he's very much my alter ego.
And he was the narrator of some of the stories in Drown.
Yep.
So, obviously, that's where the autobiographical link is, although I don't want to make too many assumptions about you. Junior is a wild character.
Sure. But my thing, I know I'm not as smart as Junior, though I'm sure I'm as cowardly as he is, because, you know, the big difference is Junior is this big, tough guy who's at heart a coward to himself, and Oscar's this big, fat nerd, couldn't hurt a fly.
Now, is that, do you think, typical that a writer feels that he's not as smart as the characters he's created?
Ah, but you know what it is, Leonard, is like, you know, when you're in a conversation, you're talking to someone, it's hard to be smart. But I can rewrite something 25 times and make Junior seem incredibly brilliant and research things. I don't know half the stuff he knows, but I just researched it and made him sound real smart.
Oscar is a fan of comic books, Dungeons and Dragons, sci-fi, and horror fiction. And reviews often express a certain amount of surprise that a Dominican boy would be interested in those things. Should they be surprised?
No, but I think a lot of books, I think most literature and most good art is trying to tear away from our eyes or from our heart the kind of calls, you know, these kind of cliche coverings that we have. It's like the plastic sofa covering some people put on, you know, and you've got to tear them off to feel the real texture, to feel the real fabric, in some ways to feel the real sensuality of life. And there are so many nerds of color, poor nerds out there, but people, again, would rather just, they're so used to seeing a kid who only wants to be a rapper, so that someone like Oscar won't exist in people's minds.
Actually, there are a number of writers who have drawn from the popular art sources, like the comic books and like Jonathan Lethem, Dave Eggers. Do you think that today's writers are more comfortable mixing high and low culture than previous generations? Is it because they grew up with these things and have no choice in the matter?
Well, I mean, I got a kind of a messed up view of it. Part of it is that the market will support it. Part of it is it's a generation who grew up with this stuff. But part of it is that the quote-unquote high folks are allowed to dabble. In other words, Lethem and Chabon can go and talk about comic books, but when they come back, their literary passports are unsullied.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, they're never up on a, you know, I always say this, they're never up at an award competing against the writer of The Hulk.
Mm-hmm.
So that the comic book writers, the low writers, if they try to enter in our world, their passport is like a North Korean passport, immediately revoked.
Now, Oscar Wao has gotten his name as part of the high art aspect of writing, hasn't he?
Well, yeah, no, it's a misunderstanding or mishearing of Oscar Wilde. And, I mean, part of the joke of this book was always that as a writer of color in a very traditional literary or artistic field, I couldn't decide which was more genre. Was Dominican writing in the U.S. or writing of color more genre than comic books? And part of the joke was I felt like being a Dominican writer, I feel sometimes a lot more in common with the writer of The Hulk than with anything else.
Well, is there a Dominican literary tradition?
Well, of course. I mean, the craziest thing is, if you think about it, the first texts in the New World would be considered Dominican.
Well, first of all, Columbus probably landed on Hispaniola, well, the island that the DR is located on.
He definitely did. I mean, the first writing about the New World are from Columbus, but you also look at Bartolomé de las Casas, his writings about Hispaniola and about what occurred there, about slavery, about the Indians. And I mean, the first books, The Brief History of the Devastation of the Indies, are about our island. So, but I mean, it starts from there. And I think that it's just a history people are not really aware of.
My guest is Juno Diaz, who's written The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao, published by Riverhead Books. And Dominican history, and particularly the dictatorship of Trujillo, plays a large part in this story. You use footnotes, often long ones, to explain your references because you want to make it clear that that's not fictional?
No, I think there's a bunch of stuff going on with the footnotes. First of all, is that unlike regular footnotes, whether in literature or in or in like quote-unquote critical work, these footnotes are actually working to undermine the authority of the narrator. Like, the footnotes keep pointing out that the narrator is getting things wrong. The footnotes keep interrupting the flow of the story. They're sort of, it's like you being on the radio and having a guest who can talk back.
There would be this little voice underneath saying, yeah, actually, Leonard's really wrong on that.
Right.
Could you read one of the funnier footnotes?
Oh, sure. And I just thought it was important because it's like a book about a dictatorship. And so it's sort of like a Shakespeare having a clown on there.
But so you give us a brief synopsis of Trujillo's reign. You say, for those of you who missed your mandatory 2 seconds of Dominican history.
Well, no, I always love that because, you know, the Dominican Republic was supposed to be a state. There was a vote in the Senate and lost by one vote, you know, and Frederick Douglass went down there to survey it. And Charles Sumner of Massachusetts was the person who beat the Dominican Republic being integrated. So I always love these kind of historical things. So this is the footnote, yeah? And it just goes, for those of you who missed your mandatory 2 seconds of Dominican history, Trujillo, one of the 20th century's most infamous dictators, ruled the Dominican Republic between 1930 and 1961 with an implacable, ruthless brutality. A portly, sadistic, pig-eyed mulatto who bleached his skin, wore platform shoes, and had a fondness for Napoleon-era haberdashery, Trujillo came to control nearly every aspect of the Santo Domingo's political, cultural, social, and economic life through a potent and familiar mixture of violence, intimidation, massacre, co-option, rape, terror, treated the country like it was a plantation, and he was the master.
And this book, to some degree, reveals that his legacy continues 40 years after. We learned about his reign through the eyes of people who lived through it. Do you think that fiction can be more effective in teaching history than a high school textbook sometimes?
No, I just think that, again, I was like, wanted to be a history teacher. I just think that we require, what's weird is to understand history, we not only require things that are accurate, but we need things that are true. In other words, just listing the amount of people that were killed in a war, that's accurate, but it doesn't make it true. And sometimes fiction, even though it's made up, can produce truth effects that are necessary.
Although there are going to be people who are going to know about Trujillo through reading this book and have no idea of anything else happening, the same way that they know about the JFK assassination through Oliver Stone's film.
Sure, but this book goes out of its way to mention a bunch of other books that talk about the Trujillo reign. So even the narrators keep saying, yeah, I might be telling you about this, but there are other people who are telling you about this, and I don't even agree with them, but to go check it out.
The other major force that affects your characters' lives is Foucault.
Oh, yeah.
What's Foucault?
Well, Leonard, I kept getting obsessed with this idea of trying to tell a story that was simultaneously, like, heartbreaking, simultaneously funny, simultaneously empirical / accurate, and then also had a folkloric element, you know? And a Foucault is this curse from Santo Domingo, where I grew up, which usually meant, like, afflicted bad luck. Somebody put a Foucault on you. That's the reason all your hair fell out. You have no kids.
Well, the Dominican Republic shares an island with Haiti, where we have voodoo. And Cuba is a nearby neighbor, and there's Santeria. Mm-hmm. Is this part of the same kind of thinking?
Yeah. I mean, Foucault is a word that comes to us from Nigeria. And it means bad luck in Nigeria. So part of it had to do with, despite the fact that these countries are all separate, they had a very similar slave regime that brought in a whole ton of people in, enslaved them, worked them to death, and usually what remained was their language. And Foucault is this force that is a negative force that's believed to have started when Columbus arrived. So you can imagine why slaves might have brought this word over, you know, and the family in the book is kind of like the cursed house of Atreus. They think that this Foucault may be the thing that's destroying their chance at happiness.
Well, you get the feeling that the entire Dominican diaspora was caused by Foucault.
Yeah, well, the narrator, again, keeps making these outrageous claims that the footnote is like, this guy's crazy. Try not to listen to him too much.
Although this is Oscar's story, at times the female characters take over the book, Oscar's sister Lola, and especially his mother, Belicia. Is that something that you had planned from the start?
No. These women characters ambushed me. Belicia, there's the grandmother, La Inca, who's a big favorite from a lot of people send me, I mean, the only letters I've gotten about this book are people saying, oh, I like your character, La Inca, but you suck, you know? So,
La Inca, because it reminds them of their grandmother?
Yeah, I think so. And I think these women just took over. What I discovered was that a story that's about lost stories often goes in a circuitous way. In other words, it's the story of the lost life of this character, Oscar. He's not even the one who tells the story.
Yeah, the story, Junior tells.
Yes. And I think that that's important. Often the most important stories we tell are not even directly related to us. They are gifts that we give the world.
We don't even realize until later that Junior is one of the characters in the story. But one of the chapters is written in Oscar's sister's voice, Lola's voice. She's a punk chick who shaves her head, but also becomes a high school track star. And that was published in The New Yorker so long ago. Is that another thing that you just realized that you had to tell a story in Lola's voice?
Yeah, what ended up happening was I discovered that there's only a couple survivors in the family. There's only a few people who at the end of the book have either escaped the curse or are still alive and are ready to deal with what comes next. And I realized that the person who could still be an eyewitness is Lola. And when I realized that, I woke up one day and was like, wait, Lola's still alive. And Lola's story just came right out.
I understand the film rights was sold to Miramax even before the novel was published. Do you think that this is something that will translate well on the screen?
Oh, my God. It's so embarrassing, you know.
Like, you're not going to write the screenplay.
I doubt it. It's like what Hemingway said. A friend of mine sent me an email about Hemingway talking about Hollywood. Drive up to the border of California. They throw you some money. You throw them the book. And then drive back as fast as you can and try not to think about it again.
Well, you teach creative writing at MIT, don't you?
I do.
And I'm sure you've spoken to other people who've had similar experiences with Hollywood. But then the movie comes out, and everybody assumes that what they see on the screen is what you wrote.
Well, you know, you keep hoping, again, that the person that you're writing for, the person that you're doing your art for, is a reader. And a reader is a very, in my mind, I mean, people have bad ideas, but in my mind, a reader is an extremely generous, it's an extremely tenacious person who brings a relationship of love to the books that they love. You know, I mean, that sounds tautological, but, you know, they bring a lot of love to their texts, to the books on their shelves.
And they also, what they get out of the book isn't necessarily what the next person gets out of the book. That's part of the thrill that we each experience a good book in a different way. What happens with your math students? Do they like to write, science and math students at MIT?
I think that that's the thing. It's like, it's the same with someone reading a book versus a movie. It's like, people who read are going to forgive you of everything because the book is what they care about. My students are the same way in some way. Most of them who are, whether they're high-energy physicists, doing quantum computing, whether mathematics, most of them come from a background of reading and the imagination. The only way that you're going to imagine yourself from the age of 10 being at MIT is because you have a strong imagination.
I can't imagine that anyone who came up with the idea of string theory doesn't have a novel somewhere in the back of
No, no, these are remarkable storytellers. And so it's a lot of fun being at MIT.
What about you? This one took you a while to write.
Damn.
Abandoned a few. Do you think the next one will be a breeze?
No, Leonard. I think the next time I see you, I'll be completely bald. it'll be another decade.
I'll be senile. It's okay.
Oh, we'll be good company, sir.
Juno Diaz's latest book is a novel. The reviews have been fabulous. Congratulations. The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde, published by Riverhead Books.
Thank you.
The first book that opened my mind when I was 13 years old was Catcher in the Rye. I thought I was a budding intellectual and so deep. Me and my middle school friends would have heated discussions about the book. I still associate the summer of 86 and adolescence with memories of experiencing that book.
Six years after the publication of Beloved in 1987, Toni Morrison became the first black woman to receive the Nobel Prize for Literature. Beloved, which examined the personal cost of slavery, also won a Pulitzer Prize, and in 2006, the New York Times named it the single best work of American fiction published in the last 25 years. Toni Morrison's latest novel, A Mercy, has been called a prelude to that earlier work. In it, she again looks at the historical, political, and emotional legacy of the slave trade, but this time during the colonial era. The book is published by Knopf, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Toni Morrison back to the show today. Hello.
Hello.
Now, Beloved was set in the 19th century. A Mercy takes place almost 200 years earlier in the late 17th century. Why did you want to write about that time before the United States even existed as a nation?
I wanted to see what it felt like to be on this continent and a slave and a female without the institutionalized racism that eventually equated slaves and race.
Because slavery at this time was just kind of working itself out, and there was also indentured servitude and other things that were forms of slavery, and we hadn't come up with the kind of slavery that became the basic part of American culture until the Emancipation Proclamation.
Yeah, well, you know, slavery itself was not unique anywhere. It existed in Russia, England, Egypt, Athens. A bound population was routine. So that in 1645, all the way through the end of the 17th century, black slaves and white indentured servants worked together on plantations. White indentured servants could appear in people's wills. Their children could be held for debt and passed on. So it was a sort of slavery by another name.
And you've written about that kind of ad hoc multiracial family.
Yes.
Here. Jacob Vark, his wife Rebecca, and the three women who work for them. The women who work for them, one's a Native American, another one is an African, another one is a mixed race.
Mm-hmm.
You said that before that you wanted to see what it felt like to be a slave at that time. Is that one of the things that motivates you as a writer to get into a topic on an emotional level, almost like an actor might take on a role?
That's the driving word. I have a question in my mind when I begin. What would it be like? What did it look like? How do people react under these circumstances? And in developing characters, I really do want to know what it felt like. And that is, I suppose, exactly what an actor does in trying to fill out a character.
And getting into the mind of each different person that
yes.
you create is part of the fun, I'm sure.
It's very much part of the excitement of fully realizing these people. I don't always describe them in detail physically because I want the reader's imagination to play that part. But I really do want to bear witness and look at the world the way they would and respond to different circumstances the way they would.
Now, since reading a novel is a collaboration between the writer and the reader, doesn't that change when you're writing a book that takes place many years in the past as opposed to something that's contemporary?
I hope not. Here we have human beings who feel safe and have the support structures taken away from them. And then I want to know, what do they do under dire circumstances? What are the relations like? And I think that's been true of all literature and all human relationships.
Can you tell us about the three women who are working on the Vark plantation?
Well, the first one is a Native American called Lena, whose family was destroyed, her entire clan, by smallpox completely. And there are only three survivors, herself and two boys. And she ends up purchased by this merchant.
Now, how would she even come to be purchased if her... If her whole tribe had been destroyed, wouldn't she just be somebody who's free to do whatever she wanted?
Well, she was a young girl, and she was rescued by some French soldiers who took her to a town, and she began to work for some Presbyterians there.
So there were Native American slaves?
Oh, sure. Yeah, many. And then when she got older, she participated in some activities that these Presbyterians didn't like, and they put her up for sale. And so she went to work for this merchant. The other girl was, I was amazed by how many foundered ships there were along the coasts in those days that just were wrecks. Sometimes they were pillaged, etc. So there's a girl who's named Sorrow, who was found as the only survivor of one of those pillaged ships. She's obviously never been on land, and she's about 11. And the third girl is the girl whose story drives the novel, a girl named Florence.
Although spelt F-L-O-R-E-N-S,
yes.
Like the
like
money.
Money.
And did Jacob Ark prefer to have women working for him rather than men?
He did. He used the indentured servants who lived nearby to do certain kinds of work.
And they're both homosexuals, so that would have been a consideration on his part?
Very much. He knew what it was like to, because he traveled a lot, and he didn't want to leave men on his property who would either rape or rob or cause some other problem. So he was happy with the women there because they were sturdy and reliable and loyal. And the indentured servants were, as you say, not interested in at least those things.
My guest is Toni Morrison. Her latest novel is called Mercy. It's published by Knopf. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Were slaves treated differently in the North than in the South during the colonial times?
By some people, I suppose. But, you know, slaves were owned by banks and legal offices.
And New York had a fair number of them.
A fair number.
There was even sympathy toward the South at the time of the Civil War.
Yes, and there were many, many free blacks, more than we would normally think. Some were adventurers. Some were people who owned restaurants down here, I mean, on Wall Street in that area. And so it wasn't so, you know, I was going to say black and white, but I mean, you know, one category slave, the other free.
Although they were treated as less than equal even when they were free, because I remember the history of Central Park, which involved raising a black neighborhood in the, I guess it would be around the 50s and 60s, they just got rid of all the people who were there who were mostly...
They didn't kill them.
No, they didn't kill them. but they did force them out of their homes because
they were
living on valuable land.
Yeah.
Jacob dies of smallpox, and then Rebecca also falls ill, and the three women realize that if she dies, they'll be in peril.
Absolutely.
What happened to slaves if their masters died?
Well, they could be stolen or claimed, particularly after, this is later, the Fugitive Slave Law, where, you know, any white person could come up and see a black person on the streets of New York and say, he belongs to me. And since
without any proof?
He didn't have proof because he didn't need any, because the slave couldn't say, no, I don't. But white abolitionists particularly knew about these sort of kidnappings, and there were beat-offs, what they used to call beat-offs, where white people and black people would run such a would-be kidnapper away from someone who was walking around the streets. But sometimes it worked. Even in Beloved, the big thing is that once she's free and in a free state, her master comes after her. And the best that can happen to her in Beloved was a trial. And that's because white abolitionists and black people were so alarmed and upset about that law.
Although the Supreme Court did not, was not sympathetic.
No, the Supreme Court was not.
Almost all the characters in this book are orphans or have been abandoned by their parents. Why did you want to explore the theme of orphanhood?
Because there was a kind of beginning of a nation of people who were either voluntary orphans or involuntary ones. They were running from something.
I mean, people were coming in, for families would break up in England, for example, and sons and daughters would just come to strike out and hope that they could establish a life of their own.
Or there were orphan churches, that is to say, the religious groups who felt uncomfortable and were persecuted and brutalized in other places. And so they came here, and they had no precedent except the way they interpreted the Bible and the scriptures.
The structure of the book is interesting. Parts are narrated by Florence in the present tense, and that alternates with third-person sections filling in the back story. Why did you choose to tell the story that way? Couldn't Florence have told the whole thing?
She didn't know the whole thing. But I wanted her language to be immediate. Because it takes place in the 17th century, I wanted that her language should be now. Everything with her is now.
And she scratches her story with a nail on the wall of the Vark House. Was it unusual in those days for a slave to be able to read or write?
Yes, of course, for anybody to be able to read and write. But she was taught by a priest when she was in Maryland who took her and her mother out to the shore, and they learned the alphabet, and he taught them with some serious possibility of harm to himself, because it was illegal to teach a slave to read.
The book has been getting mostly rave reviews, but that hasn't always been the case since you won the Nobel Prize. Do you think that people hold you to a higher standard after you win an award of that sort, or is that Nobel Prize curse that many people have talked about really a curse?
It can be, I suppose. I had a few weeks of... the fact is that after I won that prize, I had already begun Paradise. Mm-hmm. So I didn't have to think up a project, but I did have to exorcise other people's gaze, other people's expectations, and I think I succeeded then and later, because I couldn't write with that on my shoulders.
Although, thinking about reviewers, Michiko Kakutani of the New York Times really loved this book, but she didn't love Paradise. She didn't love love either. Do you read all your reviews?
All of them.
Because there are actors who refuse to read their reviews. They say that it affects their performance. If they get praise for doing a certain scene in a certain way, they say then all they do is think about that scene. And if they're put down or criticized for doing something, well, then they obsess on it.
I can see how that would be true for them, because they are really performing. I mean, they have to go out and do it. I am not terribly influenced by powerfully negative or powerfully complimentary, because I'm not that vulnerable as a writer. I'm also a critic and a teacher, so I read reviews quite differently.
Well, another critique that's come from some people, African-American writers, Stanley Crouch, Charles Johnson, for example, is that it's time to leave stories of slavery and black victimization behind and focus on America today. Interesting from Charles Johnson, whose most celebrated book is The Middle Passage, about the slave trade.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe it is time for him.
So I guess they're saying maybe slavery as a theme has become exhausted, or maybe we should move on, or now that Barack Obama is president, maybe.
Well, you know, big themes, maybe we should move on. I don't even know who the we is in that case.
Well, do you
have to reimagine history.
But you're also reimagining it with an eye to the present, aren't you?
Absolutely. I think it's important.
So do you feel that you have a personal connection to the subject of slavery other than the fact that you are an African American?
It's not personal. It's intellectual. You don't understand now unless you know what has gone on before. You don't understand it in your own personal life. How can you be a human being today unless you really have a memory?
But in your case, your grandfather was sold into slavery in Alabama, wasn't he?
Born into it.
So was that something that you heard about when you were growing up?
As a joke, yeah. I remember that he was maybe 4 or 5 years old when something called Emancipation Proclamation was forthcoming, and he heard everybody say Emancipation Proclamation is coming, and he was frightened. Nobody had explained what it was, and he thought it was something horrible. So on the day, apparently, he crawled under the bed and stayed there.
To avoid the consequences of the Emancipation Proclamation. Right. Well, I'm sure he was not alone in that. That must have been an incredibly confusing time.
I don't know. He lived to be 100. He played the violin. He had all his teeth when he died. Life was pretty good for a man who had been born under those circumstances.
My guest is Toni Morrison, whose latest novel is called A Mercy. It's published by Knopf. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Toni Morrison, her latest novel from Knopf called A Mercy. And you used to edit for another publisher, right? That was you established the relationship with Knopf while you were working, where was it, at Random House?
At Random House, yes. They were separate then.
And now they're all part of the same company, aren't they?
Mm-hmm, they are.
Which says something about the history of publishing. But was it odd working for one and root? You know, you root for your own publisher, don't you?
Well, you know, what was interesting, when I became before I became a trade editor at Random House, there was a suggestion that I might want to work at Knopf. So I interviewed there, and Bob Gottlieb was the president and editor-in-chief there, and he said, I have to be able to fire you. And I would much rather be your editor than your boss.
You were already an established writer at that point?
No, I had only written one book, The Bluest Eye, which I didn't tell anybody about because I thought they didn't hire me to do that. They hired me to edit, not write. But once it was, you know, sort of there, it was published at Holt originally. Then Bob did Sula, and I realized that the sales department was the same for both Random House and Knopf. So I split editing duties with Random House and simply spoke to Bob about the publishing part.
Is it odd to be edited by somebody else when you're editing other writers?
It may be. There are a few editors. I think Dr. Rowe was one who became writers. But knowing what editing is was very, very helpful to me as a writer.
In your, we mentioned your grandfather. You grew up in the north in Lorain, Ohio, but your family wasn't able to leave racism behind there either. When you were 2 years old, didn't someone set fire to your house?
Oh, I think that was economic. I don't
that was nothing to do with race?
No, they couldn't pay the rent and they wouldn't move. My parents, it was only $4 a month, but, you know, 1932, that was probably a lot of money. Anyway, the house began to burn, and my mother's view is that the landlord did it because he wanted them out so he could rent the place. But Lorain was not, you know, an overwhelmingly racist place. I mean, it was full of immigrants.
Although there are states like Ohio where you can be in one part of the state and be in the equivalent of the Deep South and another part of the state be
precisely
in, really in the north.
Right. In the north.
Missouri's another one of those states.
See, around Lake Erie, it was unions, factories, steel plants and shipyards, and people came there from East Europe and Italy. And, you know, all my classmates were first generation, second generation people, as well as blacks from the South. So I had this extraordinary life in a town where that was not the principal thing.
Your father was a welder?
Yes.
So he was a skilled craftsman.
Yes.
You sold a lot of books when Oprah Winfrey chose Song of Solomon as the second selection of her book club, sold over a million copies. Was that more of a push than winning the Nobel Prize? Because you won the Nobel Prize, what, after Beloved and Jazz?
It was in 93, so it was after Beloved, certainly, and after Jazz. Oprah's interest in putting my books was before that. So I was thrilled.
Well, she bought the film rights to Beloved.
She did, yes.
But it really does show you the power of television, doesn't it?
It's an interesting...
I wish I had that kind of power. You'd be selling a million books today as a result of this conversation.
But the irony is this. Here's a woman selling a million copies at the minimum of every book she suggests, but along with that sale is the implication, turn off your television and read a book. And people do.
The movie was directed by Jonathan Demme, who has mostly been doing documentaries, although he has a very nice film out now called Rachel Getting Married.
I understand. Married. That's lovely.
Did you get involved in the making of Beloved?
No, I thought I might. They offered me the opportunity to do the script, but that was territory I had already covered. And a script has none of the things I'm interested in, you know, like the tone. That's all director's stuff.
Well, some people write the scripts for their novels. Yeah. Others say, I can't sacrifice any of my characters. But then there's the other side. There are any number of writers who have been shocked by what a different story was told in the film. And for many people, that will be their novel.
Yeah.
It's like reading the classic comic.
Yeah. Well, I was sort of surprised that there were so few differences in Beloved. I thought they would leap away from the text more. And the other jobs, you know, they don't let you fire anybody, so what's the point in getting all involved in the mechanics of it when you don't know what you're doing? And it's their work.
When you look over all of your work, well, first of all, most of them, pretty much everything has been involved with the racial conflicts in this country. Is there any way to get around that? When W.E.B. Du Bois said that race was going to be the number one issue in America in the 20th century, some people said, well, he should have said the 21st century as well. Is there any way to get past that?
I don't know. That question has to be put to white people, not me.
Do you think that the election of Barack Obama, who did get a fair portion of the white vote,
suggests
that maybe America's turned some kind of corner?
A large proportion of them have. You know, the racism of old is just so useless, so expensive, so wasteful. And it hides in the, you know, I suppose, racist mind everything that is worthwhile living. It's just an easy shield to despise somebody. It sounds like more cowardice than anything else.
In Beloved, the mother kills her daughter rather than see her enslaved. Here, Florence's mother gives her to Jacob because she senses that he'll be kinder than her own master.
True.
So in some cases, it was better to go to be a slave of one person rather than another.
Well, she notes there may be difference. The interesting thing about both of those mother-daughter scenes of violence on the one hand and sacrifice on the other is that of the devastations of slavery is the destruction of the family. The beatings, perhaps, the chain, the absence of freedom. Yes, yes, yes. But as a mother, you don't know what happens to your children. You have no control over them, and you aren't given any responsibility for them. So that's a terrible thing. And there were frequent infanticides sometimes, particularly if the father was somebody the mother didn't like a crewman, somebody on a ship. They would sometimes just kill those babies, infants. But there were more instances in which the mothers would do virtually anything to keep their children. And in a situation such as the one in A Mercy, when you think you really know what horrors are going to be visited on your daughter, she would give her away.
Is that the mercy of the title?
I don't know if I want to tell you that.
There's a lot of stuff that I'm not going to talk about.
Oh, really?
Because part of the fun of reading a book like this is that we want to know what's going to happen.
I know, but you can't.
You mentioned the blacksmith who had healing powers. How would he be able to cure people?
Oh, I don't know. I read about a black slave in New England who had come from some country in Africa, but who had discovered or been told that if you cut of the bowl, the smallpox bowl of someone, and injected it into yourself, that you would not get the disease, which is precisely what vaccination was. But it was very primitive. And he was belonged to some man in New England who used his services and spread them. So that was interesting to me. And I thought, excuse me, that this African might know that, or he might just luck up, as many people did, on a cure.
Although I'm also assuming that there were people who brought knowledge of medicine from Africa and elsewhere when they came to this country. There were all sorts of things that Western medicine didn't know, that people from Mesoamerica knew, that people from Africa knew, that people from Asia knew.
True. I found a lot about ironsmith when I was developing that character, because I knew that people in Africa had been molding, had been making iron weapons and masks and beautiful art since the 10th century. So that, and it was handed down from one generation to another. So that was something that he would be extremely familiar with.
That would be in Benin?
Yes, in that area, and in further south. I went to the Quai Branly in Paris and saw that display of these incredible masks. So I wanted to give him something that was a trade and an art and a craft, and he could be well known for that and could make a living at that as a free man.
You must have done an incredible amount of research for this.
I did.
Does the story evolve out of the research sometimes?
Some details. Once you know what the weather was like or what the landscape was like, what animals were there, and you get a comfortable feeling about it and you understand more on what the people would have had to go through, what would have impressed them enormously, and then you can sense their excitement, their thrill, and the dangers that were there.
And would the animals have been very different from the animals we have today?
Well, some of them, I sort of put some animals there for a number of reasons and wrote beautiful scenes about them, only to discover they didn't exist at that time. So I had to rewrite a lot.
And is that important to you? Because there are writers who will say it doesn't really matter whether you're 100% factual, but whether the book has its own sense of reality.
Well, that may be true for some. For me, it's the opposite. Because there's so much that's surreal, almost magical in my books, I have to have the absolute facts underneath that so that the reader trusts the voice, because it really is publicly verifiable, these facts. And then I can go and leap away from that into another territory.
Now, the three women, one was indigenous to this country, the other two had been brought here forcibly. How did Jacob and Rebecca come to the colonies?
He worked for one of the companies that were here looking for resources and so on. And he inherited this space from, you know, his uncle, great uncle, and thought he would become a farmer, and he needed a wife for that, so he sent out messages by boat, and eventually somebody took him up on it and sent Rebecca across the sea to marry him.
My guest is Toni Morrison. Her latest novel, A Mercy, is published by Knopf. It's gotten wonderful reviews. Can we talk about politics for just a moment? Because you've written about the fact that when Robert F. Kennedy said in the 60s that in about 40 years America would have its first black president, James Baldwin said that was condescending. Turns out that Bobby Kennedy was correct.
Yeah, he was right on the money.
40 years either seemed too soon or too long at that time.
I wish Jimmy Baldwin were here now. I really miss him right at this moment, to see what he would believe, think, and say.
You supported Hillary during the campaign, didn't you, initially?
No. Oh, I okay. When I finally made up my mind, it was extremely difficult because of my enormous admiration for her and knowledge and her abilities. And, you know, I just felt that competence, you know, with her. So it was sort of shocking to me that when I was asked by some rather rabid Obama supporters to make a statement, I wouldn't, because I said I don't make such public statements about candidates. But then I thought about it, and they said, would you write something? And I thought about that, and I said, no. So, but then I began to look very carefully and read his book. I had read that book.
Were you surprised to learn that he didn't use a ghostwriter? That, when I interviewed him, that was what surprised me most, because the book is so beautifully written.
It's beautifully
written. Politicians don't write books.
He was a kid.
In gorgeous prose.
In my terms, he was 30 or something when he wrote that book. There's scenes, there's dialogue. I mean, it's gorgeous. So I was thinking about that, and I decided that of the two, I would cast my vote for him.
Because you always support the writer.
No, he had something different, something special. More than knowledge, I called it wisdom.
You've taught creative writing for years. You're now professor emerita at Princeton. It does help when you teach at a school where the quality of the students is rather high. Do you enjoy teaching? You obviously don't have to do it when you sell millions of copies of your book.
No, I like teaching. It's one of the things where you always, if you're good at it or interested in it, where you learn a lot. Every 4 years is a different mindset. And having to explain yourself is one thing, because I know what I know. What I don't know is what other people bring to the table, and that's what I like.
Are you working on another book now?
Just begun, yes.
And do you have, when you start at this point, how much do you know of what's going to happen?
I just have images and a few characters.
Many writers have told me that they start off with an image or a smell or a sound. I always thought you start off with an idea.
Well, I do. The idea is already there, but the actual writing, you know, you write the, that only comes, the language only arrives after the image. The idea is just large and, you know, sort of unarticulated.
And yeah, can you give us a clue?
No.
Okay. Meanwhile, you will be giving a talk and signing books tonight at 7 o'clock at the Union Square Barnes & Noble store. Do you like the touring?
This part I like. I like signing books and reading to audiences. It's the only time I see readers, you know, one-on-one. And I like that part. I like that a lot.
Well, it gives you a chance also to understand what they're responding to.
Oh, yeah. And they respond differently when I read it versus when they do. And, no, I like it. It's a wonderful experience for me.
Toni Morrison's latest novel is called A Mercy. It is published by Knopf. And a reminder that you can see her tonight at the Barnes & Noble store on Union Square. The book, by the way, is published. Did I say it's published by Knopf? Thank you so much for what the heck. It's such a pleasure talking with you again.
I'm glad to be here once more.
Far From the Tree by Andrew Solomon is about children who have fundamentally different identities than their parents. A deaf child born to hearing parents, a transgender child born to cisgender parents. The book even explores the difficulty of the Columbine shooter's parents reconciling how truly different their children were from them. There were multiple times that this book had me crying on the subway while reading. It changed the way I think about the importance of self-identity as a way to self-acceptance. It made me think about the beauty that is true unconditional love, as well as how important it is for parents to see their babies as strangers, who, though they love, they don't truly know yet. What a gift this book has been.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Even a typical parent-child relationship can be fraught with questions of guilt, love, and obligation. In his new book, Far From the Tree, Andrew Solomon looks at the most extreme and challenging iterations of this bond. Children whose identities are profoundly different from those of their parents. Children who are physically or mentally handicapped. Children who turn to crime or descend into schizophrenia, children whose needs or difficulties can present challenges beyond those that most parents are prepared for. The book is published by Scribner, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Andrew Solomon back to our show. Welcome back.
Pleasure to be here.
You make the point in your introduction that most people will tell you with some pride that they're not at all like their parents. Why are we so happy to distinguish ourselves from the identities of our parents and then so profoundly disturbed when our children turn out to be different from us?
I think we try to create a distance from our own parents because it's a way of asserting independence and character. And I think individuation is important in all societies, but it's been especially important in modern American society, the sense that you become your own person, that you aren't just playing out what your parents set for you, that you've used your own mind and your own imagination. But I think that when we become parents, all of us cherish that incredible intimacy of early childhood where your child wants nothing more than to be in your arms or in your lap or reading a story with you. And I think the sense of your children moving away feels like a catastrophic loss.
Like a rejection.
Yes.
Your title comes from the aphorism that the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, an assumption that children are inevitably like their parents.
And what I found is that, of course, all children are unlike their parents. I looked at these more extreme circumstances. I looked at deafness and dwarfism and Down syndrome, schizophrenia, people with multiple severe disabilities, so on and so forth. I'm sure we'll talk about them during the show. But what I really wanted to look at is what happens when your child has an identity, a sort of fundamental defining character trait or experience that's really foreign to the parent.
Well, isn't some of the difficulty of parenting these special needs children that we somehow blame ourselves for it or others blame us for it?
Well, the legacy of blame is strong. I was talking to Jim Watson, he of the discovery of DNA, who has a son with schizophrenia, and he said to me, the most evil man of the 20th century after Adolf Hitler was Bruno Bettelheim, who was the person who had really put forward the idea that autism and schizophrenia were caused by the parents.
Refrigerator moms.
Refrigerator mothers, parents with an unconscious wish their children not exist. And if you go back a couple of hundred years, even physical deformities and dwarfism were considered through a theory called imaginationism, which was the dominant understanding for a long period of time. They were the result of the unexpressed lascivious desires of the mother.
Well, do those kinds of blames still linger? Do people still blame the parents of children who have problems?
People blame the parents of children who have problems. There are some areas in which they blame them a lot. I did a chapter on crime. Parents of criminals are routinely blamed, even though much of the time they are not, in fact, to blame. And people blame themselves. I mean, there was one mother of an autistic child whom I interviewed. She was so bright. She was so articulate. She was so accomplished. And she told me that her son had autism because she'd gone skiing while she was pregnant. And I said, skiing? And she said, yes, and she said the altitude isn't good for the developing fetus. And I thought, okay, there are a lot of theories about autism, but that's not one of them.
On the other hand, you also mentioned statistics about parental murder of children several times in your book. They're shocking statistics. Is it true that half the children who've been murdered are murdered by their parents?
I think it's half the children who've been murdered by women have been murdered by their parents.
In fact, when a woman murders, it's more often than not
her own child, yes.
Can you explain that?
Well, I think a lot of the time that mothers have a sense that they should be able to fix things and make them right. That's what we all want to do with our children. And when they aren't able to fix something, they become more and more frustrated. We also, however, have the problem that a lot of the people who murder their own children claim to have done so for altruistic reasons. My child was suffering and I had to do it. And they mostly don't do any jail time. And if you don't have any punishment for doing it, it opens up the possibility in a very frightening way to dehumanizing people with autism in particular and other disabilities.
Well, earlier there was a time before some laws were changed when it was very common to be tested for possible birth defects, although you can't find out, you don't know about autism, but you can find out about Down syndrome, for example, dwarfism, I assume, and parents would abort their children. That didn't even come up during the debate over abortion in the recent political campaigns.
Right. I think the abortion question is a huge one, and I'm an abortion libertarian and believe anyone who wants an abortion should be able to have one. My concern is to try to explain to people what these lives are that they're choosing not to produce or to have. But I think that's separate from the general question of parents murdering the children, which is something that mostly applies to children who are 10 or 12 or 16. That's very different, I think, from an abortion. To me, it is.
My guest is Andrew Solomon. His National Book Award-winning book, Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity, is published by Scribner. You talk about horizontal identity. What's that?
So I've said that there's such a thing as vertical identity, which are the identities that are inherited from generation to generation. So your ethnicity is a vertical identity, your nationality usually is, your language usually is, your religion often is. And then there are these other identities in which a child is born who is expressly different from his parents, and his parents have to learn the vocabulary of autism or of prodigious genius or of criminality or of transgenderism or of these other categories. And my idea is that the civil rights movements that related to vertical identities came first because those identities are reinforced from earliest childhood. You can say it's hard to be a black person in the United States as the United States is currently constructed, but no one is trying to make the black children come out white. On the other hand, when you look at these horizontal identities, they present an enormous challenge to families, and the families usually try to cure them or efface them. So I'm the gay child of straight parents. My parents would have preferred that I be straight and did what they could to push me in that direction. Didn't work, but anyway, that was the attempt. So I wanted to look at how do families respond to having these different children, and how do those children at some point get a real feeling of identity?
Well, you say that vertical identities are respected as identities, horizontal identities are seen as flaws. So that, and that's an important part to make that kind of distinction.
Absolutely.
Does the parents wish to mainstream their child, if possible, to intervene in some way, mean anything other than they wish their children's lives to be made a little easier?
You know, there are two threads. One is that the parents want their child's life to be easier. And the other is that the parent may find it embarrassing or humiliating or unpleasant having a child who's ill and having to do all of the things that are connected to that child. And I use the word illness very advisedly, but having a child who's different in some way. And it's often hard to separate out to what extent are they trying to make life better for their kid and to what extent are they trying to conform to their own standards for themselves.
With vertical identities, it's easy to connect to your child, to bond, but they can sustain a relationship. But when you have a horizontal identity, it's really difficult to bond.
It is extremely difficult, and yet a lot of the
But aren't some parents, aren't bonds of love and acceptance supposed to transcend those flaws? At least we'd like to believe they do.
Well, we'd like to believe they do, and I really feel the message of the book is that they often do. I mean, it has a lot of harrowing stories in it about people confronting enormous difficulty, but they're mostly stories in which love is ultimately triumphant. And while I saw a lot of cost to that love and a lot of struggle associated with it, I did find that while we all know there are abusive and neglectful parents, even if children without any problems and certainly of children with problems, that most people actually love their children and want the best for them.
You say that the genesis of this book was an article you were assigned to write about deaf culture. What did you know about deafness at the time?
At the time, I knew nothing about it, and I thought it was only a disability, and I thought those poor people who can't hear, it's too bad we can't do anything for them. And then I went in to talk to people who are in the deaf culture, and I went to deaf theater, and I went to deaf movies, and I heard or saw deaf poetry, and I was at the Miss Deaf America competition, and as I had those experiences, I became more and more convinced that deafness was a linguistic subculture. It's not my culture, and I didn't want to go deaf and join it, but I had to admit it was as valid as a culture as Jewish culture, gay culture, Latino culture, whatever.
But is it different if it's a vertical or a horizontal situation, if the parents are deaf or the parents are hearing?
If the parents are deaf, the children tend to function better because they've had reinforcement in sign language as a first means of communication from earliest childhood. If the parents are hearing, the parents often focus on oral speech and lip reading, and then as the children get a little bit older, the children discover identity by meeting a peer group. And that's what I mean by horizontal. It's from your peers that you actually do the learning.
Was the controversy at the time the fact that hearing people were running deaf schools, particularly at the Lexington School?
There was a huge controversy about the hearing people running deaf schools. Lexington had just had a new president appointed, and the people who were there felt that it was the wrong person and that it should be a deaf person and not a hearing person. There were big protests at the time.
Well, you mentioned the debate over whether children should be taught to sign or encouraged to try to speak, which is true for deaf children, also true for nonverbal autistic kids.
Yes. I think that the sort of central question in the book is, how do you figure out what about your child can be changed What about your child should be changed? What about your child should just be left alone? And what about your child should be celebrated? And with a lot of these things, I mean, now there are cochlear implants for deaf people. The questions are very different from what they essentially were when I started 20 years ago looking at these problems. But a lot of the time you find parents who are trying to cure what's not curable, and that's a path to disaster.
And we're still seeing that sort of thing argued over, for example, in California, where there are now court cases over a new law that says that you can't try to straighten out gay people through some kind of conversion therapy.
Right. I think the question is always whether you need to ban cures that don't work. If it were a medical cure, if it were a medication, and it were determined definitively that it not only doesn't work but makes someone much sicker, then I think we would knock it out right away.
Well, how did that work with you? Because you mentioned earlier that your parents would have preferred for you not to be gay.
And I think I would have preferred at that time for me not to be gay. And the life
you
I
mean
have...
gay people don't choose that lifestyle, as some people claim?
Oh, dear, we're back to the choice question. I think that I really had the sense at the beginning that the way I was an undesirable way to be. But I also think I was living in a society which was unbelievably prejudiced against gay people. The idea when I was a child, when Time magazine described homosexuality as a pitiable second-rate flight from reality and nothing more than a pernicious sickness, that we could get from there to having a president who endorses gay marriage, I mean, it was unimaginable. And the life I have with a husband and children was unimaginable. So I was very unhappy about who I was, but I was unhappy about who I was partly because of my parents and partly because of the larger world. And it's the fact that what I experienced as an illness is now an identity that made me think some of these other illnesses could be identities.
Well, you were here before to talk about your book on about serious depression. Do you think that your experience with depression was related to what happened to you when you were a kid, or would that just simply be a chemical and a genetic thing?
I think that there's no question that it's all tied together. I mean, to try to imagine whether I would have had a depression if I weren't gay is trying to imagine whether I would have had a depression if I were a completely different person. Would I have had one if I were the Prince of Wales? Would I have had one if I were a pro football player? I don't know, maybe. But I would be a completely different person. For me, though, I think that experience of not liking myself and not liking who I saw myself to be in adolescence left some permanent scars.
Did writing this book help you to forgive your parents?
I started off to write the book because I had felt that my parents took a while to come around to my being gay. And they really came around to it, but they were uncomfortable with it at the beginning, and I was very angry about that. And as I worked on the book, I thought, love is something that actually can exist even without acceptance. And I thought what happened was that for a while my parents couldn't quite accept who I was, but I think they always loved me. And in looking at all of these different experiences and seeing the way in which the process of negotiating difference is consistent across such a diverse set of questions, I thought, okay, my parents actually did a pretty good job on the loving front. So I ended up being less angry. I thought everyone has to struggle with this.
In the rave review you got in the front page of the New York Times Sunday Book Review, the reviewer wondered whether this book would be read mostly by people who have children of the sort you're discussing, or whether everyone should read it because some of these issues really apply to just bringing up children.
So I've kind of said in the same way that we test flame retardant pajamas in an inferno to make sure that our child's sleeve won't catch on fire if he reaches across the stove, that I've looked at these extreme circumstances and tried to see what people do under such pressure, and that I think that by doing it, it illuminates the general experience of parenting, which is to say that I have yet to meet a parent who doesn't at some point say to his child, "Where did you come from?" And I think when a father or a mother says that, they're having to deal with the fact that their child is a separate person, and that's the universal parenting experience.
My guest is Andrew Solomon, author of The Noonday Demon, an Atlas of Depression, which was a Pulitzer Prize finalist and winner of 14 national awards, including the 2001 National Book Award. He is a lecturer in psychiatry at Cornell University and special advisor on LGBT affairs at Yale University Department of Psychiatry. His latest book, also an award winner just the other day, right? Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity, is published by Scribner. We'll continue our conversation right after this. We're back with Andrew Solomon. His latest book, Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity, published by Scribner. And I've been circling around an award. What I've been thinking about was in the Sunday Times, just this weekend, they had a list of the 10 best books of the year, and one of them was the book we are discussing, Far From the Tree. How did you conduct your research for this book?
The research was incredibly labor-intensive. The book took 11 years to write. I ended up with 40,000 pages of interview transcripts. I went off to try to find people in each of these communities that I was looking at.
So, was everybody willing to talk to you? I'd imagine some people would be rather reluctant. These are the deep, dark secrets of many people's lives.
Yes. I found that a lot of people have a great need to tell their story. But what I found most of all was that a lot of these people said, what I experienced made me feel very alone. And if telling my story to you will help someone else to feel less alone when they're going through their experience, then I'm game for it.
Now, we mentioned deafness, which can be invisible unless people are conversing through sign language on the subway, as I just saw this morning. But dwarfism is impossible to ignore, and people do stare. What kinds of issues do parents of dwarfs have to deal with?
Parents of dwarfs have to deal with the fact that their children are seen as comical. One of the dwarfs said to me, it's like being a celebrity without any of the money. You've got everybody recognizing you. You've got everybody looking at you. You go out to eat. I go out with dwarfs who have become friends. I could be with Madonna or a ring-tailed lemur. I wouldn't get more stares. So I think they have to deal with that. They also sometimes have to deal with health complications, skeletal problems.
But they don't have to be – there's no issue with mainstreaming because there are no intellectual differences.
There are no intellectual differences. There is a big controversy about this procedure called limb lengthening, which is a very traumatic physical procedure in which the bone is broken in many places and then it begins to knit together and it's pulled apart and knits together. It can give people some extra height, but it means years in a wheelchair. So there are some parents and some dwarfs who want to do that. There's also a very strong resistance to it as inhumane and barbaric.
And it must be really tough for these kids when they reach the teenage years and puberty.
I think it is. I think a lot of them have lots of friends when they're younger, and then when they get to the dating age, people don't necessarily find them erotically appealing and therefore are less interested in dating them. But that's why I think in this community, as in all, it's important to have both a foot in the sort of outside world and a foot in a community of other people with your same situation.
Well, is this a purely horizontal situation, or does dwarfism run in families? Does deafness run in families?
All of these things can run in families, but most dwarfs are born to parents of average height. It's usually a chondroplasia, is usually a randomly occurring genetic mutation. Some of the other kinds of dwarfism are caused by the particular combination of parents. But certainly dwarfs who have children have a good chance of having children with dwarfism.
What about Down syndrome?
Down syndrome, of course, is also in general a randomly occurring genetic mutation. And Down syndrome is one of these areas, like deafness actually, where we have enormous social progress at the same time that we have enormous medical progress. And they're intersecting in a very strange way. So people with Down syndrome are now living three times as long as they lived 50 years ago. They have educational and cognitive attainments that were unimaginable. The experience of Down syndrome people is vastly exalted at the exact same moment that we're developing blood tests to allow even more people to terminate such pregnancies.
But we had to have a baby Doe law fairly recently, 1984, that prevented people from letting their children die pretty much through starvation.
Yes. So until that law was passed, it was considered acceptable and in some cases even advisable to let children with severe disabilities just die. And I think that that created a feeling of darkness, not only obviously in the families in which children died, but also for the families who wanted to keep their children, where other people looked very disapprovingly at that.
Well, most Down kids are happy and affectionate. That must be some kind of compensation for the parents.
Oh, I've now met a lot of families of people with Down syndrome, and Down syndrome is difficult, and there's heartbreak when you run up against limitations, but the depth of the emotional connection is profound over and over again, and most of the people I met feel deeply in love with their children.
And you're right about Tom and Karen Robarts, who founded the Cook Foundation in New York City, both Harvard MBAs who worked on Wall Street. So how did they react to their son's disability?
So they were involved in helping to bring about some of the educational reform that has taken place. They started this very tiny center, which then grew to actually be an important force in the education of such kids. The thing that was most striking to me in my conversation with them was when I talked to them about it all, I said, well, you've devoted the last 23 years of your life to trying to help people with Down syndrome. It's been your whole focus. Do you wish it had never happened? Do you wish your son didn't have it? And his mom said, you know, for David, I wish that he didn't have it, because for David, it's a difficult way to be in the world, and I'd like to make his life easier. But speaking for myself, well, I would never have believed 23 years ago I could get to such a point. Speaking for myself, the experience has made me a better person than I would ever have been, and I wouldn't give it up for anything.
Didn't many of the parents, no matter what the problem with their child, express something similar?
A lot of them did, and at first I thought, it's so curious that all of these parents with all of these children with all of these challenges wouldn't rather have some other children who don't have those challenges. But I thought, it's really the universal nature of parenting. I mean, if some glorious angel dropped in my living room ceiling and said, I'm here to take away the children you have and to give you others who are nicer and brighter and more attractive, I would be horrified. So I think that parents form deep attachments to their children. And I think, if nothing else, that working on this book showed me that those children, with all of those conditions, are as fully human as anyone else, fully human to their parents and should be fully human to the eyes of the larger society.
My guest is Andrew Solomon. His latest book, Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity, published by Scribner. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. One of the big controversies, returning to autism for a moment, is why we've seen this explosion in autism. Some people say it's just better diagnosis, but others point out that where it used to be one in many thousands and now it's one in a few hundreds, it can't just be a diagnosis issue. What did the people you spoke to suggest might be the causes?
There are so many theories that are circling around and nobody really knows. One of the causes may be older fathers. There's some fairly robust stuff saying that older fathers are more likely to have autistic children and people are reproducing later. But there are so many possible environmental toxins. There are so many experiences. There are issues of whether mothers have been using their cell phones while they were pregnant. There are a million things out there, and none of them has yet had any real substance. But it appears that there are genetics strongly involved in autism and that those genetics may be becoming more concentrated.
Do many marriages, they all feel the strain. How many fall apart due to the stress of an exceptional child?
You know, there are studies that argue that more people get divorced with these children. There are other studies which actually have shown that fewer people get divorced, and there are a bunch of studies that say it's all the same. So the research is confusing. But my shorthand was that a lot of the time, people with very strong marriages, the marriage got stronger as they united around the problem, and people with marriages that were already troubled tended to break up completely when they were confronted with something this overwhelming.
And did money was that a factor at all? People were more comfortable and could withstand all of the expenses?
I think the expenses are an enormous issue, but I also found that people who are wealthier are often more perfectionistic and like to be able to solve and fix problems, and that in some cases, people with fewer advantages had an easier path to accepting children whom they wouldn't be able to fix. So money can be mostly a blessing, but it can also be a problem.
And, I'm sure a lot of parents also worry about these children outliving them. If they are always in need of care, what happens then?
So one of the big questions is placement. At what point do you have a child like this? Do you put them in some kind of a home? And there are lots of parents who say, this child will live with me as long as I live. But the problem with that is that then when the parent dies, the child has to not only adjust to having lost a parent, but also to going to live in a new place with new routines and so on. And it's often more humane to try to move the child when you can do so gently and when you can help the child to make the adjustment. But it's a very difficult call because you get more love at home. There's no question about that.
When we talked about people blaming themselves earlier, you mentioned when a child commits a crime. Isn't that fundamentally different from the other conditions that you examine here?
My purpose in including that chapter was to show that the experience of parents of having these difficult, incomprehensible children can have to do not only with how those children were born, but also with where they came from, which is why I have a chapter on children conceived in rape, or what they do, which is why I have the chapter on crime. And I feel like we finally stopped blaming parents for autism and Down syndrome and dwarfism, and we still blame them for criminality. And I think our doing so is incredibly unproductive because often, as I looked at these stories, the criminality felt to me more like a disease than many of the diseases I was looking at.
You say that you wanted to write about criminals since you saw Paul Van Houten making the case for parole for his daughter, Leslie Van Houten, who was one of the Manson girls. Why? What was so? What struck you so much about that interview?
I felt that he still saw her as the child he had nurtured at home, and that he couldn't wrap his mind around the fact that she had really committed this terrible crime. He kept saying, oh, well, it was just because she was on marijuana. He was sort of still making excuses for her. And I thought not being seen is something, one of the many things that can drive people toward extreme acts.
There's a scene in at the end of Rosemary's Baby where she realizes that her child is the son of Satan, but she feels as though she can raise him to emphasize the better part of his nature.
Yes, well, that's what everyone would like to be able to do. And if you actually have the child of Satan, it can be tricky.
And I'm sure there are people who, when the kid is really being difficult at 3 or 4, wonder whether they have begotten the child of Satan. You also spoke to Tom and Sue Klebold, the parents of Dylan Klebold, who was responsible for the Columbine killings. Why do you think they were willing to talk to you?
They hadn't been able to talk for a long time because they had various pending lawsuits. And Sue had heard me lecture, and we therefore had some basis for beginning. But I think they were very full of their story, and they wanted to tell the story, A, that they had not been not only up and supportive of, but had been horrified by what Dylan did, and B, to talk about the fact that actually he was a complicated person who ended up doing something appalling, but that there was more to him than that. I think they wanted to tell their story. I remember Sue Klebold describing to me how good he had been at math as a child and how he would do equations on the refrigerator. And then she said, you can't imagine how long it's been since I got to boast about my son.
Well, we always hear when somebody does something terrible that he was a nice boy, he was very courteous, the neighbors liked him, because we're all complicated.
I think we're all complicated, and I think many of us are unknowable, and I think Dylan Klebold was very good at keeping secrets. At the end of the first weekend I spent with Tom and Sue, whom I interviewed over 5 years, we were exhausted, we'd recorded 20 hours of interviews, we were sitting around the kitchen table, and I said, is there anything you'd want to ask Dylan if he were here now? And his father said, I'd want to ask what the hell he thought he was doing. And his mother looked at the floor and thought for a minute and then said, I would ask him to forgive me for being his mother and never knowing what was going on inside his head.
But I seem to remember that Anna Freud said all teenagers are psychotic on some level. And it's really hard to tell the difference between a kid who's just acting strange and a kid who might really do something awful.
Absolutely. And I saw a home video that had been taken of Dylan going to his prom 3 days before the massacre. And I thought, okay, he seems a little grumpy, but he's 17. 17-year-olds seem grumpy. I wouldn't have known.
You also include a section you mentioned earlier on rape victims who've kept their child. For the most part, was that a matter of choice?
It was for the most part a matter of choice. Some of them kept their child through religious conviction, some of them because they didn't really believe they were pregnant and didn't organize themselves well enough to deal with it, some of them because they were in situations in which they had no access to termination.
Well, you went to Rwanda, but would the children of rape there, which was part of the Civil War, be the same as the child of a rape victim in the United States?
I went to Rwanda because I wanted to look at how it was in a society in which what is exceptional here is something that's happening on a mass scale. Those women never had access to abortion. It's not legal in Rwanda. And they had been through so much pain and so much difficulty. And I always remember the last one I talked to who said to me when I asked her at the end of an interview whether she had a question for me, she looked at me and I thought she'd ask how long I was staying in Rwanda or something. And she said, can you tell me how to love my daughter more? And I said, to love her. And she said, yes, I want to love her so much. But when I look at her, I think about what happened to me. Can you tell me how to love my daughter more? And unfortunately, it was only much later that I thought how much love was in that question itself.
But you decided, despite all of these conversations, to become a father during the course of writing and publishing this book. Did it change your perception on how you might proceed as a parent?
You know, a lot of people were incredulous that I was having children while working on this and said, but it's a book about everything that can go wrong. And I said, it's actually not. It's a book about how much parental love can survive even when everything goes wrong.
But you did say you hoped that you would be spared the experience of having an exceptional child.
I did, but I believed that even if I had one, I would be able to love him, and that was what I had needed to discover.
But would you, one of the people you speak to is the parent of a prodigy who was already looking into the theory of relativity at the age of three. Would that have bothered you?
Having looked at the issue of prodigies, which is one of my favorite chapters, I found that having the mind of an adult in the child of a, in the body of a child is not that much easier than having the mind of a child in the body of an adult. So I hope that my children will develop deeply, profoundly, and to an extraordinary extent, but not so early as to have no peers.
You actually had a scare after the delivery, didn't you?
Yes. The day after our son was born, the pediatrician came in and said he wasn't extending his legs correctly, that that could be related to brain damage, that he was extending them inconsistently, asymmetrically, and that that could be related to a tumor of some kind. It was this terrifying thing, and we ended up, it was only about 5 hours that we were having MRIs and so on, but with a newborn, the day after he was born. And I felt at the time, on the one hand, my book is about how much meaning people have found in these experiences, and on the other, I was hoping not to have them.
We got a call from Diana Montford, who says she's the world's first transgender journalist on cable TV since 1990. And she asks, how is it that some people can overcome prevailing ideas, especially parents, like her own very accepting parents, while others can't?
I think different people have different levels of flexibility in them. I think that they come from different backgrounds and different social circumstances. I was appalled as I worked on the transgender chapter by how much hatred there is for transgender people, how much pointless, ludicrous, reasonless hatred there is, and how much hatred they have to go through, many of them from their own families. Many other families were incredibly accepting and loving, and I felt the ones who were accepting and loving were the ones who saw the child as a separate being and wanted his happiness or her happiness, rather than the ones who saw the child as an extension of the parent.
I understand you've started a website.
Yes.
Are people writing in and talking about their own experiences?
They are, and I'd love for more people to do that. It's farfromthetree.com, and the idea is to build a hub where people can compare stories. Because I've argued that really, while each of these differences individually is isolating, there aren't that many people with schizophrenia, there aren't that many people with Down syndrome, the experience of dealing with difference within the family is huge and universal and bonding.
And we will post a link to it on our show page at WNYC.org. Andrew Solomon is a lecturer in psychiatry at Cornell University, special advisor on LGBT affairs to Yale University's Department of Psychiatry, and the author of the National Book Award winning The Noonday Demons, An Atlas of Depression. It was also a bestseller. And now, Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity, published by Scribner, chosen by the New York Times as one of the 10 best books of the year. Thank you so much for being with us again.
What a pleasure it's been. Thank you.